Hi, this is Burl Bear. Our guests, the authors of Defending a Monster, John Wayne Gacy. Howard Lapidus joined me in the interview, as did Mark Boyer. We're going to pick it up with Howard asking about the smell of decaying bodies.
But let's talk about the smell of decaying flesh.
There wasn't any.
It didn't exist. You know, that was a bunch of garbage. And actually, that was a, when issuing a search warrant, the police need something. And Gacy had a, the crawl space was kind of a typical crawl space that wasn't really dry at the time, and there was a damp, musty odor in there. But there was no odor of decaying flesh in that house. He put lime over the bodies.
Right.
He covered the bodies with it. I mean, do you go to a cemetery and smell decaying flesh?
No. Well, they're 6 feet under.
It was all caca. You know, when people say they smell decaying bodies, there was no smell in that house.
Tell them I want to... I want to go back here to the phone call. Let's just take it from your perspective. You've got to get a call for this John Wayne Gacy guy. Oh yeah, I know him. Okay, fine. He calls. What's the conversation?
So you're a young defense attorney. Phone rings. Ladies and gentlemen, there he is, right?
There I am. And he calls up, and he knew me. He says, "Hey, Sam, how are you?" "Go, hi, John. How you doing?" And he's like, "You do me a favor." As I usually do, like if any of you guys call me, I'm talking to you on the phone now. We know each other. I said, "Sure, no problem. What do you need?" And he said, "Can you find out why the displays police are tailing me? They're ruining my business." I said, "Oh, what do you mean, why are the displays police tailing?" He said, "You know all those guys over there. My office was right next to the displays police department." And he said, "You know all those guys. Just find out. You know, because they're really, I don't know what's going on. They're tailing me. They're ruining my business." And I said, "Well, I'll try to find out, John. I know all those guys. I'm sure I'll be able to find out. Don't worry about it." And that was basically the first phone call. It was a very short phone call. And then I went out and started talking. I mean, I didn't look at it as some big case that was coming into the office.
Right.
Let's do this guy a favor.
Okay. Then what happened?
What a favor it was.
Then what was the next thing that happened?
Well, he called me. And then I proceeded, and I didn't have a lot else to do in private practice other than set up, put my pictures on the wall and do different things and again, do the transfer of my cases in the public defender's office. So I took it on, and I went to the police department. I talked to the chief, Alfano, at the time, and he wouldn't give me any information. I talked to some of the local policemen I knew, and they wouldn't give me any information. Talked to Herb Volberding, who was the mayor of Des Plaines, and all these people would tell me, "Your guy's a real bad guy." And I said, "Bad guy? Come on, he's a clown. Everybody knows him in the neighborhood." The kind of things I told you, he has these big parties, goes to children's hospital and helps kids out. "No, he's a bad guy, he's this, that, and the other thing." Then I went to Terry Sullivan, who was the chief prosecutor. The opposite end where I was, he was the supervisor in the state's attorney's office. And I asked him, he said, "No, Sam, your guy's a bad guy. He's got a background and this and that." He didn't tell me too much, other than there was a kid missing in a drugstore, who was working in a drugstore. Gacy happened to be in there, and they suspect that Gacy had something to do with the missing kid. And I wouldn't believe, I really couldn't believe him, because I said, "This guy's he's a good guy. Everybody knows him, he's a really good guy." And a little bit at a time came out. And what I did do is send my secretary at the time. This was a girl, Earl, who could get anybody to say anything about anything at all.
Mm-hmm.
Anytime I needed any information, I would send her out to talk to the police. And whatever police officer, whatever detective knew something, she would find out about it.
That's a rare talent.
Oh, yeah. She had a very, very, very rare talent. Anyway, she went and tried to do what she could do, and she came back to me and said, "Nobody will tell me anything." So I knew something was brewing. Something was pretty big with this guy. And then finally, Terry Sullivan told me that Gacy had a background of sodomy in Iowa, which I was shocked to learn, and he had been sentenced to 10 years in jail.
So, Judge, awesome. Judge, help me out again. Who's Terry Sullivan? Help me out with that.
Terry was
a big piece.
The chief prosecutor in the Northwest Suburban area.
So he knew, and the cops knew, that this guy's a bad guy.
Oh, yeah. They knew at that point.
They suspected, yes.
Right, of course.
But they weren't about to tell me a lot. You know, in the meantime, Gacy kept meeting with me. He kept giving me some crap. He would tell me the story about what happened the night that Robbie Peace, his last victim, disappeared, but he wouldn't tell me about what happened to Robbie Peace.
Right.
He didn't know anything about him. He happened to be there. he was a victim of circumstances. And as his lawyer, that was my position, that he was a victim of circumstances. And even though he had a, then I knew he had a criminal background, that even made him more of a victim than anything.
Sure, they're picking on him.
Suspected. This guy, they're picking on him because of his background.
This is,
I was getting more and more aggressive to try to stop the police bail. You know,
this is Mark. I was wondering if he actually served the 10 years for sodomy.
No, you know, and we actually bring that out in the book, that he's a kind of a sad indictment on our criminal justice system. Had he served that entire 10-year sentence, I believe the last murder took place would have been almost 10 years to the day.
Yeah, on the same day.
That he would have been in jail. So none of those kids, had he served his entire sentence, none of those kids would have been killed at Gacy.
But according to the system, he followed the rules. He was a model prisoner. He was out in, what, 18 months or so?
A little more than a year.
And
he was a model prisoner.
But he went off into his killing spree. Did they not know in jail? Could they not? See, here's what really, guys, this is what really amazed me.
He manipulated everything, bro. He was the consummate con man. He manipulated the jail warden. He manipulated the other inmates. The guy was the consummate con man. You wouldn't know he was a killer. I mean, he had a marvelous personality, and he was very, very, very intelligent.
Sam, just like us.
Sam, when did you find out he was a killer? When did you know he was a killer?
Well, about a week after he came in. You know, Danny could probably tell you the story because he's the guy who wrote
it. Danny, how did you fit into this? I'd like to, let's bring you into this picture.
When I graduated from law school, the first place that I worked was Amaranti in Etchingham, long, long, long time ago. And I've known Sam for all this time. And then I wrote a small, a little novel, and Sam read it, and he saw that I could write, and we kind of hooked back up. After he went on the bench, I went and had my own practice. So that's how we got back together.
Right.
And as far as the night that, I mean, Sam tells it too, but as far as that night, Gacy was asking Sam to see him one more time. He had something else that he wanted to tell him.
Yeah, Dan, you know, and I was really aggravated with him. I was totally pissed off.
Yeah, you've got to tell this story, Sam. I mean, I wrote it, but you got to tell it.
Yeah, you wrote it really great. I was really pissed off. I was really, really pissed off this guy, because my kid was sick, bro, my older son, and he had a real high fever, and he was hospitalized, and I was staying with him all night. Gacy was being, the tail was getting heavier and heavier on him, and he was playing games with these coppers. He was playing games with me. He was playing games with everybody. You know, and I, unlike I've been portrayed in some of these movies, you know, like this, you know, kind of a little laid-back guy, you know, I'm kind of an aggressive, short Italian guy, and, just picture that. And I was, you know, I was really getting aggravated with him because I kept hearing the same bullshit over and over and over again from this guy, and by this time I stopped believing him. I had a polygraph set up, and he was supposed to take a polygraph in the morning. I think it was a Thursday morning or something, because I just wanted to, I had to know whether he was lying to me. I get a call that night, and I had been up like 3 or 4 days already. I get a call, and he said he wanted to talk to me. And I said, John, what do you want to talk about? What do you want to talk about? I don't want to hear the same old bullshit from you. If you got something new to tell me, tell me. I'll talk to you. But otherwise, I don't want to hear it.
Okay? Hey, so Sam, me. That's you to your client? You're telling him, you know, you're basically full of it?
You're damn right. Is what I told
okay,
you.
Keep
that's,
going. No, this is
that's
great.
What you have to do to your client.
This is great. Go ahead.
That's not unusual, by the way.
I lie to you, bro. I mean, they all lie to you.
Right.
Anyway, so he came. I told him, something. He said, it is something new. I have to talk to you. It's very, very important. I said, all right. It better not be the same old thing. So I set up I left the hospital where my son was. And I called the other lawyer, whose name was Leroy Stevens, who was representing Gacy in some civil stuff. And we met at my new office in Park Ridge, late at night, about 11 o'clock at night. We were waiting there for him. Gacy pulled up with his tails right behind him, the Delta Force, police officers. And we go into the office, the cops stayed outside, and we sit down. Comes up with the same old shit. And I lost it. I start yelling and screaming at him, you know, pounding my fist on the table. I said, Jesus Christ, John, you know, you bring me here in the middle of the night, my kid's sick, I don't want a beer, I'm tired, I think you're bullshitting me, you know, and I went through all this with him.
Right.
He's kind of looking at me like a little puppy.
Right.
And he says, and I start pointing at the boy's picture in the newspaper, in the front of the newspaper, Robbie Peast, who was missing. I said, John, look at this kid. I said, this is a good kid. He's missing. You were there. You have this conviction of which John told me was called sodomy of films, which was bullshit too. But he said, I said, look at this picture. This kid's missing. They say you have something to do with it. He looks at the picture, bro.
Yeah.
He looked at me, looked at the picture, and looked at me. He said, this boy's dead.
Jeez.
Not the boy who was in the drugstore, but he's dead. He's in the Des Plaines River. My God, you talk about, wow, my heart started pounding. I'm like, what the hell are you talking about? He said, do you have anything to drink around here? And I happen to have a bottle of VO, which I still have somewhere, it's an empty bottle now, bottle of VO in my car, which was given me as a Christmas present from one of my investigators.
That's a closed, this is Howard, by the way, that's a closed bottle, right? Come on, Judge.
It was a closed bottle.
Thank you. Okay.
For the record, it was a closed bottle.
Thank you.
I run out to the car. It's freezing cold in Chicago that night. It was horrible, icy snow. Run out to the car to get. I see the poor police officers, his tails, sitting in their car freezing in his old jalopy. They see me grab the bottle of VO. I said, you guys want to come and wait inside a minute? We don't have to wait out here. I think it's going to be a long night. They come into my, not the lobby of my office, but the lobby of the building.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Here on the first floor, outside of my office. I sit them down there, ask them if they wanted coffee, if they wanted a shot, and they didn't want anything. And I went back into the office where Leroy and John were sitting there, not saying anything. I poured a little shot in each plastic coffee cup that we had and toasted for Christmas. Gacy said, fill it up.
That's right. This is a few days before Christmas, by the way.
A few days before. So I filled up the whole plastic coffee cup. He gulps it down. He's like, you fill it up again. Fill it up again. He gulps it down. Then he looks at me, eyeball to eyeball, and he said, look it, I've been the judge, jury, and executioner of many, many people. Now I want to be my own judge, jury, and executioner. I don't want you to stop me. I want to do things my own way. I'm going to handle this my own way, but I'm going to tell you the whole story. And it started in 1972. I was driving around the Greyhound bus station on Clark Street in Chicago, and I saw this kid walk out of the bus station. And the kid was looking for a ride. He was new into the city, and I gave him a ride. Then he went into this long thing for all the rest of the night. For hours, Leroy and I just sat there and didn't say a word. And
you must have felt like you were in another dimension.
Absolutely.
Listen, we got to take a 60-second break, Judge. We'll be right back with this horrifying story of your relationship with John Wayne Gacy on True Crime Uncensored. Hang on, we'll be right back. There are some things in life that just don't go together. But listen to this. You take one drop-dead gorgeous woman. You add an incredibly wealthy, handsome man. You put them together. They have all the money, clothes, jewels, drugs, alcohol they could possibly want. Well, then you throw in a Glock 9mm handgun. It's all good fun until someone gets killed. Fatal Beauty, the shocking true story of beautiful Rhonda Glover, who put 13 bullets from a Glock 9mm into her boyfriend of 15 years, Jimmy Jost. Oh, she said he was abusive. The friend said he was passive. Either way, he was dead. Fatal Beauty, available January 2011 from Pinnacle True Crime by Burl Bear, living legend true crime author. And trust me, he's brilliant, I know it, because I am Burl Bear, author of Fatal Beauty.
If you own an iPhone or ride the plastic pony in front of Kroger, you are no longer tied to your computer. You are now free to roam and take Outlaw Radio with you everywhere you go. Grab an Outlaw Radio iPhone application, the smoking, drinking, interrupting. Did I say interrupting? 24-hour party that you follow now follows you. Your iPhone is now the easiest way to stay connected with your friends at Outlaw Radio, like me. Change the way you listen to the radio 7 days a week, now available at the iTunes App Store.
Back to True Crime Uncensored with Burl Bear and Howard Lapidus, featuring Mark C.G. Boyer and sometimes Marie Mackey Esquire. Produced by Magic Matthew Allen, who in turn is produced by Laurie Downey Jr.
I am the legendary Burl Bear. Howard Lapidus is here. Mark Boyer. Judge.
I'm here, by the way, at the good wishes of Don Waldman. When Don returns, then I will...
Don's on the island of hiatus.
We want him back.
So right. There you go.
By the way, this is there. Isn't that, didn't I read that he's the executive producer of Celebrity Rehab?
Mm-hmm, yeah, that's me.
I love that show.
Well, thanks, Judge. Thank you very much. Thank you.
My wife and I watch that show religiously.
I watch it, too.
Danny, thank you. I appreciate that, Danny. I'm hoping you guys are watching season 5.
Love the doctor, too. I was listening to him when he was on the radio.
And still is. Every night. Still is on the radio. He's on the loop in Chicago every night. So,
Celebrity sex show on, too.
Now, that we took off. And we're here to talk about John Wayne Gacy, but I'll quickly say, just because thank you very much for... I will pass all your good wishes on to the doctor, and I will. The sex rehab show, which I thought would be the biggest, was our worst. It was terrible.
Most people do enjoy sex, whether it's with celebrities or unknowns.
But, you know, today we lost a very large celebrity to what looks like the disease of alcohol and drug abuse.
Yeah.
And Amy Winehouse. Yeah.
Oh, no, really?
Yeah.
I haven't heard about that.
She died.
Oh, jeez.
She was found this morning.
Well, let's get
that
back
was a matter of time.
Yeah.
Yes, it was, and we reached out to her, but unfortunately, we couldn't get to her.
Very sad, but not unexpected.
Yeah.
Your aha moment. You're sitting there, and John Wayne Gacy is laying out this horrifying story. You must have been dumbstruck.
Well, the way I describe it, bro, the most people are like, you're not seeing me here, but you know, I'm on the radio. I'm only 5'2", and I tell everybody I was 6'4" before that happened. Lost about 14 inches off my stature. It was tough. It was like the longest night of my life. I aged years. It was a surrealistic experience. I was dumbfounded. I was in awe and dumbfounded and scared and everything. And not physically scared, but just professionally.
Did you know at that point that you were going to take the case? Did you think that this was something that you were going to have to live with? Is that where your fear was?
You know, no. I never even thought about that, about taking the case. He was my client.
Right.
That was it. I mean, I never thought about it. It was my case, and he was my client.
Right.
And, you know, I never closed the door to him if he wanted to get another lawyer. He even talked about calling F. Lee Bailey at one time. And I said,
He did much better.
But he... you know, so I never really thought about it. He was my client, so I never thought about whether I was going to take the case or not. The fear was, what the hell do I do? What do I do with this guy? I mean, he's going to go... He's told me this horrible, horrible, horrible story. He's going to go out and do it again. Nothing's going to stop him. He was talking about building a second story in his house because he had nowhere else to put the bodies anymore. He had a... although he loved the drive down to the Des Plaines River in Joliet, and it was like a pretty area that he liked, he really didn't like the inconvenience of going there to have to dump bodies off. That's why he talked about it. And so he wanted to make sure his house, he could put more bodies in there because he ran out of room in the crawl space. So he was going to build a second story in case he had to put bodies up there. And
was this bothering him?
He was a lawyer. I mean, ethically, you know, what's your obligation? Those kind of thoughts went through.
Well, hang on a second. Back up a second, if you don't mind. What is your obligation? If he's sitting there telling you he needs to build a second story to store more dead bodies, you as a officer of the court, what's your responsibility?
Well, you know, it's a real tough line because my responsibility, number one, is to my client to get my mouth shut because that's privilege. It's absolute, unequivocal privilege if he's telling me about a crime he's committed. Now, on the other hand, as you correctly point out, if he's talking about a future crime, I certainly cannot be part of that. And as an officer of the court, it's my duty to try to stop that or to go to law enforcement or to go to some body somewhere to let him know that it's going to happen to prevent it. Otherwise, I'm part of the crime.
Even if it's off the record. It's a small town. You guys kind of all knew each other. When you said you were afraid here, it's 3:00 a.m. or whatever time it is, and you're hearing this unbelievable confession by John Wayne Gacy, who's one of the, you know, the worst mass murderers of all time, sitting in your office, and now he's telling you, not only has he done this body of work, so to speak, but he's got a future plan.
And he wanted to show us the crawl space. He wanted to show us where all these bodies were, which he did not want to see. See, the word, if I hear his words, that's privilege. And I cannot repeat that. I cannot disclose that. That's privilege. But if he shows me where the physical evidence is of a crime,
right,
then I'd have a duty to disclose that. Well, then there's a question there, because at the time there was a Supreme Court case pending for two public defenders out of New York who knew where a body was, and they wouldn't disclose it under privilege. They were ordered to disclose it by the courts. They were held in contempt. The issue went all the way up to the Supreme Court, and they were ordered to disclose the whereabouts of the body. The court held that there was not privilege because it wasn't, you know, the words, the claim. They saw physically where the evidence was. So I didn't want to see it. I knew about that case, and I didn't want to see.
But where do you draw? Where's your moral line, Sam? I mean, as a matter of disclosure, I represent two fairly high-profile attorneys, in Mark Garagos and Mark Aguilar. So I have these kinds of discussions with them because it fascinates me, you know, as to where and to be able to talk to you and have the privilege of talking to you about it, and both you guys, defense attorneys. Where's your compass go off? You know, into polar south.
You know, that's where the fear, and like I said, it wasn't a physical fear, it wasn't like a fear of him, it was a professional fear. Where does that line stop there? Did he really tell me about a future crime? No. I mean, I knew he was going to, his thought was to continue doing this, that he was in a situation where he was going to be confronted with that again. But do I disclose that? I can't disclose that to anybody because it's not a specific crime, that I'm not being made part of a crime or a plan. This guy was crazy. He was crazy, and what do I do for that? So what I decided to do, the way I handled it, Burrow, was after, well, Gacy went up falling asleep after a few hours.
And after a few more drinks.
Was he an alcoholic?
No, but he used to take, I wouldn't say he was an alcoholic, but he used to mix booze and marijuana.
Valium.
Valium, a lot of pills, Valium. But I wouldn't really say he was an alcoholic. The guy worked. He was a workaholic. He worked 20 hours a day, and I think a lot of it was so he would avoid getting into that Dr. or Mr. Hyde personality. Most of the time he was Dr. Jekyll, and he was working hard and trying to keep himself out of trouble. And then when he would find himself in a situation where he was engaged in a sexual act with somebody he really didn't want to be involved in a sexual act with, which he said never was by force, but he conned himself too.
And you're talking about males at this point.
Males.
This is a guy that was married twice. Whatever happened to his biological kids?
You know, I don't know. And that is a very, very good question, because I always wondered, what kind of study could be done or what they turned out to be like.
Well, my question is genetically, yeah, there we go. We're both on the same page. Yeah, genetically,
there has also been the emotional content as well.
Well, that's a whole other part.
Yeah.
It's a whole other piece.
The other thing, I would just interject, the other thing about Gacy is the way he was raised. And, you know, I mean, he was clearly homosexual, and he hated homosexuals. He had more of a conflict raging within himself than you can imagine.
Why the hate for homosexuals?
His father. Imagine this.
He confessed to hate for homosexuals.
Yeah.
Whether he really hated them or not, because he was homosexual.
Well, don't you think? My guess in studying this is he? That was one big front.
Well, tell about the deal with his dad, Danny.
Imagine the expectations of a man who names his son John Wayne. You know, people often say John Wayne Gacy Jr. John Wayne Gacy was not a junior. John Gacy Sr. was John Stanley Gacy.
Right.
So this man, he named his son John Wayne. And what he got was a fat, clumsy, sickly boy who played with girls. Played mostly with his sisters. And there was a conflict between his father and him that lasted all of their lives. And John spent a good portion of his life trying to make up for that, trying to please his father, which he never did.
Oh, I thought his father finally came around at one point. Did he not?
No. His father died. That was one of the problems. You hear me? Did I lose you again? Hello?
Yeah, you're there.
Yeah, we got you. Everyone's here. Hello?
Yeah, we got you.
We're all listening intently. Go ahead, guys. We were talking about his dad and him never pleasing his dad. So he never pleased his dad. So therefore, we've got a guy that was completely conflicted and always reaching out and trying to please his dad. And he was supposed to be the big John Wayne figure, et cetera, et cetera, and wasn't. So
correct. I'm wondering if we still have Sam. Sam, are you there?
Did we lose Sam?
Hello.
There he is. Okay,
Dan. Wrong with the wire in this phone here.
Okay, well, Danny, why don't you go ahead and tell us about the relationship with the father?
I was saying, his dad died when he was in jail. That was one of the problems.
Yeah, he died on December 25th, by coincidence, 1969. And when his father died, John, although he had made it fairly well in business, they never really had any kind of reconciliation.
Well, didn't his father used to call him a sissy and beat the crap out of him and stuff
Absolutely.
Like that?
Absolutely. Fruit picker, sissy,
well,
et cetera.
That's why I asked about alcoholism and drug abuse, because usually, with that kind of a background.
Dad, I think, was an alcoholic.
And alcoholism.
I think Dr. Drew might call him an alcoholic.
I think his dad was an alcoholic. His dad used to be, he was a hard-working old Polish guy, blue-collar, who expected his son to be a tough kid, and but you know what the thing about that, Danny and I have our own arguments about this, and I've argued with the doctors about this. I mean, a lot of kids are brought up like that. My dad was a tough blue-collar worker.
And mine.
A lot out of me, and Danny's was. We didn't become serial killers, we didn't become conflicted.
But they didn't abuse you for the heck of it.
Right, and the thing is, with that, and interestingly enough, his dad used to abuse him, and his dad used to go hide down in the basement all the time.
Ah, it all starts to fit together, the whole basement thing again. Didn't he just steal his mother's undies or something and bury
him? Right, he buried him. He buried him in an organized fashion underneath the porch, which is like a little crawl space area, almost in the same fashion that he buried the bodies many, many years later.
So it's like the same play over and over again.
How many years, Sam, did you represent him? And I know you did the big
actually
trial.
Actually, my total representation was for 15 months.
Okay,
so December 78th until the end of the trial. Then we filed our notices of appeal. But I didn't represent him on appeal because we wanted a fresh, the lawyers to take a fresh look at
sure.
the case.
So do you see him every day?
Every day for 15 months.
Yep. No, I'm talking about today. Do you still see him? Does he cross your brain at any time now, or have you just forgotten him?
No, I wouldn't say I see him every day. Something reminds me of him every day. I mean, if it's a kid, what it really did, bro. When I was a judge in court,
mm-hmm.
and I would sit up there, and I'd have hundreds of people come in front of me, and I would think about that case every day, and I talked to kids about it, and I would talk to parents about it, and I would talk to defendants about it, and really, in a way, I thought made me a better judge, because it gave me that sort of insight into things. And some days it haunts me, some nights it haunts me, some days it makes me think that it was a good thing that came into my life, because I've been able to help other people.
Yeah, I would interject that Sam was the author of a law in the state of Illinois that over time was the precursor to the Amber Alert. It started the ball rolling. It created a situation in the state of Illinois where the report of a missing person, child in particular, but person, would initiate an immediate search rather than a 72-hour waiting period that used to be in effect. It was policy that they wouldn't even look.
That makes such a big difference.
Yes, and plus it was a statewide search. And when other states started doing that too, then it became possible to do a nationwide search for a single person reported to a single police department.
So, guys, and Danny, in writing this book with Sam, Are you haunted by this in any way? I mean, does this guy touch you, or do you look at this as a almost an inanimate object, something that didn't happen?
It's a story. And, the story that I wrote...
But Danny, it's not a story.
Burrow, he's haunted more than I am, because you know what? He has all his clothes and everything.
I have all his clothes.
You're not burying him under the house, are you?
I removed those things from my house. I gave another, actually a radio personality who is a kind of a Gacy follower, I gave him Gacy's jacket. I used to have the leather jacket, and I had his wallet, and I had all these other Gacy things. I had him in my house for a while. I had his suits that he wore at the trial, and I had a cat that sniffed those items one day. They were in a box, and this cat's tail fluffed up and started hissing. I said, I have to get these things out of here. These are evil. These things
why does this sound like Steve Dahl to me?
No, it wasn't Steve Dahl. Okay. He's actually a friend of mine, a client.
Right.
But he's...
Steve's a client? Don't let me go.
No, I'm Steve. Not Steve.
Okay.
But I wind up giving them all to Danny. When Danny started writing the book, I gave every. I put him in storage because I didn't want him to do it.
It came with the file.
He's got him in his living room. Nice.
Well, I noticed a review of the book, Danny. Someone compared you to Hemingway. I hope you don't shoot yourself when the show's over.
Speaking of shooting yourself, okay? No, in all seriousness, and I'm kind of going down this road because of how spooky this is to just read, but your book is, I can't wait to do it from cover to cover because it's just the story that you guys have painted is fascinating. But living with it, guys, Sam, living with it as a client, Danny, living with it as an author, and I look back and I see guys like Jason Moss who blew his own head off, who lived with this and documented it, and I don't think could bear even being alive anymore because it's so damn scary.
I write these too, Howard. You have to emotionally insulate yourself to a degree. Otherwise,
detachment.
You have to have a degree of professional detachment. You can't write the book.
That's okay. That's as you guys as a writer. But Judge, you had to sit in the room with this guy for 15 months, day in and day out, day in and day out, and you're trying to somehow figure. And let me get this right, and correct me if I'm wrong. At least you're trying to establish insanity to at least not have the guy die. Am I right? I mean, what was your end goal? I mean, he confessed.
Yeah, save his life.
Did Burrell just say that? I mean, our end goal was to save his life. Was to, we're looking at him as a client. I mean, in looking at him as a client, you don't lay judgment. You don't think about those emotions. I mean, you can't do that when you represent somebody. It's he's a client and you're trying to protect his rights. And our theory was to save his life. To keep them institutionalized, to have them studied, to prevent something like that from happening.
Well,
in the future.
It's what Jose Baez said at the end of the Casey Anthony case. Baez said he went home and told his kids he saved a life today.
That's correct.
That's exactly how you feel.
Well, you did your best to. You were not victorious in that process, and I did see an interview with you on television where you commented, I believe, that the jury was so overwhelmed by the horrific nature of these crimes that they really couldn't perceive or really pay attention to the defense.
Right.
Am I correct on that?
My job, I would have been very happy had I saved his life. I mean, my theory was to save his life and to prevent something like this from happening in the future. That's my job as his lawyer, to protect him. And, people think, defense lawyers do things begrudgingly or don't want to do it. Hell no. We're true believers. We believe in our system.
Sam, are you a father?
I am a father four times over.
Okay.
I have a 36-year-old son, a 33-year-old son, my 36-year-old who was sick at the beginning of the AC case. My 33-year-old who was only a few months old when that started. They were the reason I wrote the eye search law, because I looked at him and thought, number one, if those were my kids, Gacy would never make it to trial, okay? I'd find a way to get him as a man. But number two, you can't do that because we live in a civilized world. What would I do if I were a father? Where would I turn to my kids? That's what made me think about the eye search law, my two sons. And I also have an 18-year-old stepdaughter, and I have a beautiful 5-year-old little girl. And do I think about Gacy every day? Sure, when I look at those kids, I think about them. And would I kill somebody, myself?
Hello.
Hello.
Right at the good part.
Yeah.
You're damn right. I'd go after them if they hurt my kids.
But if you weren't representing Gacy, and Danny used the defense attorney. If you weren't representing somebody like this, how'd you feel about the death penalty, if, having heard that he killed so many people and had this intent?
If I weren't representing him, just as a man, not
yes,
as a lawyer?
As a man, as a dad?
I'd want to kill him myself.
Yeah. I've often said that. Yeah, I've often said
about the case because I would think parents.
Yeah, he's got trouble with that phone.
Yeah, he keeps going in. And now, what I always say is that I feel the exact same way. I have a 16-year-old son, which was about the age
that's right, the wheelhouse he was searching for. Right.
And if anybody ever heard a hair on his head, they couldn't hide from me. But I don't want a criminal justice system that reacts like a victim of a crime. Because sometimes the victim's wrong. Okay. Sometimes the idea that this is the guy and I'm going to get him is inappropriate. It's wrong.
I believe you're right, Danny. But here's a guy that you know has killed multiple, tens of 16-year-old boys. You know, it's not like one, and maybe you're not quite sure, and the victim,
But also, he knows that he believes that this guy is insane.
Okay.
Yes, and that was the defense, and frankly, that is true. He was insane. He wasn't insane.
But they were never able to prove that, right?
Well, no. See, the problem is that there's a legal definition of insanity, and then there's nutcases.
Yes.
Okay?
Well, let's talk about the differences so our audience knows.
Well, it also depends state by state. You have the McNaughton rule in the state where this trial was.
That's correct.
This is the state of Illinois.
At that time, yes. So the easiest to understand difference is you can't know that what you did was wrong. So if you have a John Hinckley and he walks in front of cameras and tries to kill the president to make Jodie Foster like him more, that's crazy. But anyone that would do these kind of crimes is also crazy. But the fact that Gacy hid his crimes made Sam's job a very tough
because it
job.
Shows that he knew that it wasn't socially acceptable.
Yes, to say the least.
Yeah.
Am I on, guys?
Yeah, you're on now.
And then there was a definite element of premeditation in his preparations for the disposal of the body.
That was the state's position. The state's position that there was an element of premeditation was our position that there was not premeditation. That when he found himself in a certain situation, it would just happen. And if he ever were released from prison, if he found himself in that unstructured situation, it would happen again. But he didn't plan these murders. He stalked and he went after people, but he didn't plan him. He didn't plan a particular
murder. Did you discover any evidence or indications that when this situation arose that he did anything to prevent himself from doing it, where he tried to outthink himself?
Well, other than working extra.
Right. Well, he worked extra. That was one way. But then, even when he was engaged in situations, he didn't kill everybody. I mean, he was engaged in situations with people where he would lose it and act like a monster and act totally bizarre. And then he would just change. He would switch over. I mean, this was it was such a bizarre, strange situation because it was very similar to the novel Jekyll and Hyde. Where, Hyde was, there was such a split in the personality, and that was Gacy. It was so hard for the doctors to even figure that out. Because one minute he would be the nicest guy in the world and be very cunning and very manipulative while he was doing that. The next minute he would turn into a raving madman.
Isn't that schizophrenia?
Stories,
no, right? Not so much schizophrenia.
That's what they couldn't figure out. It was a
psychosis NOS. Yeah.
Yeah, he's an enigma, okay? They're
as most serial killers are.
Yeah. Who was it? Bundy. Bundy had, he was a law student. He was socially active. He had friends. He had people trying to get him jobs and all that sort of thing. And then he would have this other side to him. There are very few people.
And Bundy even went out of his way to make sure. He says, what's the state where if I get caught, they're most likely to give me the death penalty? And that's where he goes, commits a crime, and then drives back and forth along the border waiting for them to catch him.
Yeah.
Right. And that's the sort of stuff Gacy did. That seems to run true in all serial killers. they play cat and mouse games. I mean, Gacy would have the police tail him. He'd lose their tail. Then he'd call them up and say, "You lost me. How stupid can you be? Tell me stupid. I'm over here."
That's absolutely true.
And then he'd say, "Go get away with murder." You know, just stuff, little hints he would drop to them.
But he had the kind of personality that the tails, the police officers that were tailing him, used to go to his house for dinner, used to go to bars with him.
That's driving me out of my mind, guys, because, you know, these are guys that are, you know, they are entrusted in keeping a guy like that away from my kids, and they're splitting a pot roast at the house.
But they don't know he's the guy yet.
Well, but what are they doing there, Burl?
That was the only way to engage him. They had to somehow engage him. They're waiting for him to talk a lot.
Right.
There's different techniques. And these guys were on him constantly.
So that's a technique, is to pop over for turkey dinner.
Because they were playing the. They were playing in the Gacy's web, but he was also playing in their web. I mean, he was playing his little cat and mouse games as serial killers do.
But he wanted to eventually get caught. When he told you in the office and he confessed to you, was there this massive sense of relief? Did you see that come over him?
While he was talking to us, we did. But then, after he fell asleep, he woke up and I didn't finish that story. He fell asleep. For a while, we made an appointment with the psychiatrist. The way I handle it is we made an appointment with the psychiatrist at Weiss Memorial Hospital in the morning. We called a number of doctors, and we finally found one who would see him. I was planning to have him commit himself and then try to work it out from that, but we had time to figure things out. He was going to be committed. And then he fell asleep, and when he woke up, he totally forgot that he told us everything.
Oh.
He came walking at me in a half asleep, almost a... hypnotic state or a sleepwalking state. He's walking right toward me with his arms up. I picked up a baseball bat in my office. I was going to hit him with a baseball bat.
Oh, a couple things. Why was there a baseball bat in your office?
Yeah, I'm a White Sox fan. It was an autographed baseball bat.
Okay. Did you record this interview when he confessed?
No, okay. I was going to record an interview with their client.
Okay. I don't know.
I recorded everything immediately the next day as to what he told me. I have that recorded for my dictation purposes.
You still have that?
Absolutely.
Great.
But it was just, it was a horrible night.
So when we read the book, that's going to be, you're going to be going almost, word for word from that, correct?
Yes. To say a few things about the book,
please.
First of all, Sam is the living incarnation of Rudy Baylor. The story is not scary, okay? The first couple chapters are... You have to tell the reader what this guy did, and so those chapters are scary. The rest of it is a legal thriller, and but every word that's in quotes in that book, particularly words spoken in court, are taken straight from the transcripts. It was a labor. It was an interesting experience because I used the actual words. I had the actual words. Now, in the front of the book, I had to improvise a bit, but I was taking that from statements to the police. We had statements from his mother, statements from the Peast family. And so I could piece together what actually happened between the two of them in that house that night. That's the part that's scary. The rest of the book is a legal thriller, and it's a great read and an interesting.
Well, the reviews, the advanced reviews on the book are fantastic.
Mm-hmm. I would like to know. This is Mark. Why now?
I never was able. I've been wanting to do this for a long time. And I struggled. We talked about privilege before. I certainly struggled with the issue of privilege, even after somebody's dead. I mean, there's certain issues regarding privilege, and I struggled with that. And I always wanted to tell this story to set the record straight for history. I wanted to tell the story the way it should be told, the kind of story that would send a message, sort of like in the genre of In Cold Blood, that kind of nonfiction novel. I could never find anybody to do it. I wish I had known Burl. Burl, I would have called you.
Then Daniel would be out of work.
I mean, you'll do the next book. Call me, and I'll make the deal for you.
But I read Danny's work, and I knew Danny for a long time.
Right.
And most people who were going into the book with me made it sound like I did it begrudgingly. I did not do this begrudgingly. I did it because it's my job, because it's my passion. You know, I'm a lawyer, I'm a defense lawyer.
Did he want you to save his life, or did he want you to have him killed?
Gacy?
Yeah.
I bet you half.
He wanted to save his life. I mean, he convinced him.
Gacy didn't know what he wanted, to be honest with you.
There you go.
Gacy was crazy. Yeah. But, you know, Danny Broderick was the first, and he knew me. Danny knows my personality. He worked with me as a lawyer. He worked in the courtrooms with me. And then finally, and we just sort of reconnected after all these years, and Danny had written this other book called Buford Tucker, and I read that, and I liked it. And I said, boy, Danny could really write. And then he started putting his Gacy thing together, and it was what I always wanted it to be, how I always had envisioned it, and it turned into a great story.
Now, guys, the story's been told 5-6 times by others. How do you feel about some of those things? Without, you don't have to get totally specific, more of a general question.
Well,
did anybody hit it right, or is there a lot of it kind of speculation and fiction?
Nobody's hit it exactly right. You know, Terry Sullivan tells a good story in his book, Killer Clown, from the prosecutor's viewpoint.
Right.
And as far as the other books written on it, nobody really had the, you know, they had all the bullshit, like I said before. You know, they used the Gacy bullshit. And that's what I wanted to clarify. You know, a lot of things written in those other books were things that Gacy, in his cunning, manipulative way, was able to manipulate people and tell them what Gacy wanted them to hear. And what we have is a true story. We have the story from the very beginning. I knew when he was lying. I knew when he was telling the truth. I knew what he had done. And we have the story from the beginning. And frankly, seeing some of these other productions and seeing some of the movie productions would sicken me. For instance, they had that one Gacy movie that Brian Dennehy played Gacy.
Right.
I love Brian Dennehy. He's a great, great actor.
Lovely
but
man.
Type casting Brian Dennehy as Gacy would be like casting Dudley Moore is Superman or something.
Well, plus, and Brian, God love Brian, he was 25 years older than Gacy was, you know.
Gacy was older. That big, mean kind of guy. He was like a Santa Claus.
There's a film that came out this year, or is coming out this year.
Dear Mr. Gacy.
Yes.
I thought, what's his name's portrayal of the actor?
Forsythe.
I thought his study of Gacy, I actually met with Forsythe quite a few times.
Yeah.
And his study of Gacy, I thought, was the best out of anybody, and I thought his personality, the way he played Gacy's personality, was the best that was portrayed of any of the...
What about your book? Is there a movie deal for that?
I hope so.
I know you hope
someday.
So.
Someday, if you guys know anybody. I know everybody.
Howard knows everybody. If he didn't know him, he invented him.
I sit here every week and I just pick off movie rights from great books.
Okay, you got to read the book.
Oh, don't worry. I don't have to read anything. I love this story. I will read the book. There's no question. I'm waiting to think it's out August 1st, if I'm not mistaken. Right, guys?
Correct.
First, yeah. I would like to collaborate with Terry Sullivan, the prosecutor, because I think a real great big screen movie would be a combination of our two books. From the prosecutor side, the defense side, and would be a great...
Let's make that deal. I just said that. That's what we're capable of doing. No problem. You know,
I want you guys to say hello to my dear friend Georgia Durante, who I absolutely...
Oh, hello. Gosh. Oh, yeah. Georgia Durante.
We got her picture right here in the light-up lounge.
Do you know Georgia Durante?
Oh, sure, yeah. She slept with everybody whose name in
hey,
the
bell. Hey, bro, that's not where we were going.
Oh,
here.
I'm sorry.
This is a friend of the court. What is the matter with you?
I love Georgia.
As we all do.
Your Honor...
Now that we've made the movie deal, and I like that idea of collaborating with Terry Sullivan and putting the two of them together, and I'll just take a piece of the whole thing. All kidding aside, let's do it. All kidding aside, I love the story. But all kidding aside, let's do this, and then are we done? No.
I think we're done.
Let's get these guys back in a couple weeks.
All right,
my
we'll
God, this was a fascinating.
Come out to California.
Like, oh, we'd love to have you here.
We're going to be out there. We're gonna try to be out there the end of August.
Oh, right, you gotta come here!
We'll ask George to come too.
Matt Allen, he just heard your best. He's just in the other room producing the show, so absolutely.
Yeah, thank you for everything, and thank you. Get a great
Judge,
show up.
Danny, come see us. Love.
Thank you very much. Hey, I gotta mention the Facebook page, John Wayne Gacy, Defending a Monster, and the website is defendingamonster.com.
And the book is also called Defending a Monster. What an amazing coincidence.
Yes.
First of August, a couple weeks away. It's a great read. Can't wait to do it myself. We're going to.
Thanks again,
guys. Thank you very much.
Look forward to seeing you here live in the lounge. Thank you very much. Coming up next, of course, the thrill of a lunchtime. Magic Matt Allen and the Demons of Decadence, including, of course, Howard Lapidus, the legendary Burl Bear, Mark C.G. Poyer, Johnny Cosmo, who's going through Michelle Bachman's husband's therapy, and he'll be as manly as the rest of us by the end of the show. You don't have to bend over, Johnny. You can stand up straight. Come on.
The podcast you just heard was recorded with Anchor. If you want to make your own, download the Android or iOS app completely free from anchor.fm/podcast. That's anchor.fm/podcast.